So you people are supposed to remember. You can't expect me to remember things. After all, I'm supposed to be an absent-minded professor, right? That's part of the job description. Anyway, my apologies to whoever is listening to this tape, if anybody is, but I started a little late again. Public goods are one more example where the word sounds like something people understand and isn't, which gets confusing. Because a public good to an economist does not mean a good the government produces. There are public goods that are privately produced, and there are private goods that governments produce. A public good is a good which has two characteristics. The first is that it's non-excludable, which means that if you produce it, it is going to be available to all the members of some pre-existing group of people. So if I broadcast a radio signal, it isn't available to everybody. You can't pick it up in France, but everybody within a certain distance of my broadcast can get it, and I don't have the option, as I would if I were selling books, of saying, if you don't pay, you don't get it. Either I produce it or I don't produce it, but if I produce it, everybody within that area gets it. And the second characteristic is that it's non-rival, meaning that your listening to the radio broadcast doesn't stop somebody else from listening to it. Whereas your reading the book does mean that that copy can't be being read by someone else at the same time, unless he's looking over your shoulder, and that's sort of inconvenient. So I want to argue that it's the non-excludable that's the important part, that the non-rivalrous just means that it's a natural monopoly with marginal cost zero, that is to say, one more person using it doesn't cost anything extra. But that doesn't really raise the public good problem, which is how do we get paid for something when we can't control who gets it. So what's the problem? The problem is, how do you pay for those public goods that are worth producing? So imagine there is a public good where the benefit to the people who will use it is $1 million, the cost of producing it is $500,000, but how do I, who produces it, get more than $500,000, given that each user gets to use it whether or not he pays me? So my standard example is a flood control dam. So this is a really profitable one. It costs $1 million to build the dam. There are 1,000 farmers downstream. Each of them benefits by $10,000 through not having his fields occasionally flooded when floods come. But how do I get him to pay for them? Each farmer, as we were discussing before, correctly believes that whether he agrees to pay for it is unlikely to make the difference on whether the dam is built. And if the dam is built, he gets to use it even if he didn't contribute. That's the public good problem. How do we pay for those goods that have that characteristic? How do we get them produced, really? Let's consider some private solutions, because some public goods are privately produced. And the standard example is radio or television. That's a pure public good. Can't control who listens to it. How do we get it produced? And we get it produced by this brilliant idea that some unsung genius came up with, which is to produce not one public good, but two. One of the public goods has a cost of production, positive cost of production, and is valuable to the consumers. The other has a negative cost of production. We call that an advertisement. And why does it have a negative cost of production? Because if you're a radio station, advertisers will pay you to put their advertisement on. It may have a negative value to the consumer, but you tie the two tightly together by giving your broadcast interspersed with ads. As long as the package has a positive value, consumers listen to the radio, listen to the ads, and you can pay your bills as a radio station. All right, so that's one example of a way of producing a public good privately. Consider a different example. Let's try my dam story, but this time assume there are only 10 farmers. I draw up a unanimous contract. All right, the contract says, I agree that if the other 9 people listed on this document agree to chip in $5,000 each, I'll chip in $5,000 for the dam. If anybody doesn't sign, I'm not bound. Well, you're one of the farmers. What are your choices? You say, well, look, if anyone else doesn't sign, it doesn't cost me anything to sign. If everybody else signs, I get the dam by going in and don't get the dam if I don't go in. Right? So that's a unanimous control, a unanimous contract solution. But if you think about it, it works less and less well as the number of farmers goes up, because it becomes harder and harder to believe that all the rest will do without the dam if I'm the SOB who refuses to pay. In addition to which, maybe I claim, well, I don't mind floods. I'm planning to grow rice anyway. I like floods, so of course I shouldn't pay for the dam. How do you know I'm lying? All right. Another possibility, suppose we've got lots of farmers, but they aren't all equal. There are two big farmers, and each of them gains $1 million from the flood control dam. And then there are 98 ones, each of whom gains a few $1,000s. The big farmers get together and say, look, those little guys down there, there's no way we're going to get them to pay for the dam. If we build the dam, maybe they'll like us and be more friendly, and that'll be nice, and they'll invite our kids over for playing games or something. But basically, if we want the dam, you and I are going to have to pay for it. Unanimous contract with two people isn't that hard to organize. Even if the two of us pay for the whole cost of the dam, it's still worth getting because it's still worth, even just to us, twice what it's costing us. So we do it. And the odd terminology in the literature is that the big farmers are referred to as a privileged minority. And it's odd because their privilege is to pay for what everybody else is getting. But because each of them gets a large enough benefit, it's worth their doing. I think there's some evidence that Google thinks it's a privileged minority for the internet. That my impression is that some of the things Google is doing are spending money on things they think will make more people use the internet, because if more people use the internet, more people will use Google, and they can make more money selling ads. And I'm not sure, but it's at least possible that that's the reason for the phone that I've got in my pocket at the moment. This is the Android G1. It's using an operating system produced for free by Google. And I think their hope, at least, is that with a good free operating system out there, many different manufacturers and cell phone companies will adopt it. Since one of the things it's good at is connecting to the internet, that will result in more use of the internet. I'm not sure that's what's going on, but that may be what's going on. I'm a privileged minority if I repaint my house. Because after all, my neighbors would rather live on a street with houses that look nice, right? And they're not paying for it. And in principle, I could try to collect a buck from each of them, but it's not going to work. But I get enough benefit because I'm the one living in the house, and I really like having my house look nice. Well, this is not true because I haven't repainted my house, but let's suppose it were true, that I'd be willing to pay the whole cost. All right? Another private solution is that sometimes there are ways of making what used to be a public good excludable. So that if I switch from over-the-air television to cable television, now you don't pay Comcast, you don't get your programs. If I go over the air but encrypt, now I may be able to go to each listener and say, pay me for whatever you need to decrypt it. If you don't, you can't listen to it. So I've been treating the fact that it's not excludable as if it were sort of chiseled in marble, but sometimes that can be changed. So the basic point is, public good doesn't mean necessarily produced by government, but it does mean a problem for producing it privately, which we've discussed and which there are sometimes ways of solving. There may also be legal solutions. Because in some cases, you can make something excludable by just changing the law. And copyright is the obvious example. That if I write a book in a world without copyright law, I've just produced a public good because everybody else can copy it. Computer program is a better example because photocopying books is expensive, but copying programs is cheap. So if I produce Microsoft Word and I don't have any copyright law, now anybody who has a friend with a copy can have him burn him a copy, and now I've just produced a public good. So copyright law can be thought of as a way of turning a public good into a private good. One could do the same thing conceivably for radio. Suppose we pass a law which says, in order to listen to any radio station, you must have permission from the station. And they can sell that permission for any price they like. And we will hire people to sneak around with microphones and listen to who is listening to which station. And if they find somebody who's listening to a station they haven't paid for, they'll get sued or fined or whatever. It would be a costly way of doing it, but it's not narrowly imaginary because that's what the United Kingdom does do. They don't do it by stations. But the system I think they still use, they certainly used to use, was that in order to listen to, I'm not sure if it was radio and television or just television, you had to pay a special tax, which went to the BBC to put on the programs. And if they detected you listening to one and not having paid the tax, you got a fine for doing that. So they were doing, on a somewhat coarser version, what I'm describing. Similarly, if you think about grazing land with cattle, if you have an unfenced area of grazing and I graze my herd on it, you graze your herd and so forth, now the land itself is a public good, and if somebody goes to the trouble of watering the grass to make it richer, everybody's going to benefit, so nobody's going to do that. How do we solve that problem? We build fences. I have a fence around my part of the range. You have a fence around your part of the range. It now pays me to fertilize and water the grass in my part, and only I use it. But fences cost something. So it might be that the gain from that might be more or less than the cost. In the case of the U.S. West, my understanding is that prior to the invention of barbed wire, cattle raising was mostly on open range because fences were too expensive to build, and barbed wire provided a much cheaper way of building fences, and you then started moving towards closed range. So that means that one solution to the public good problem is simply to change your law in such a way that the good becomes includable. To say, it is illegal for your cattle to trespass on my land, it is illegal for you to make a copy of my computer program, and so forth. On the other hand, making a law doesn't result in enforcing the law. So there are costs to enforcing it, and sometimes they're bigger than the benefits. And this is my story about why we owe civilization to the dogs. This is a hypothetical story, but as far as I know, it could be true. And I want you to imagine that it's about 10,000 years ago, and a recent innovation is the invention of agriculture. And my tribe, your tribe, our tribe, farms the land in common. Got this area of land that we've cleared of trees, and we all dig with sticks into the ground and plant stuff and carry in gourds water to water it and harvest it and so forth. And it's a real pain. Partly it's a pain because primitive agriculture was a pain. But aside from that, we spent half our time arguing. You didn't do your job carrying enough water yesterday. That piece that you were supposed to plow up, you barely scratched. So not a very good system. And I'm the clever young man, and I say to the elders of the tribe, I've got a better idea. And my better idea, I think I'm going to call it private property. And my idea is we divide this field up, and each family gets their chunk of it. And each family then grows land on their crops, on their chunk, harvests land on their chunk, and so forth. I don't have to worry if you're lazy, you don't have to worry if I'm lazy. If I'm lazy, I go hungry. If you're lazy, you go hungry. And the elders say, look, kid, it sounds great. But it just so happens the tribe over the hill tried that 5 years ago. You want to know what happened? What happened? What happened was that instead of spending all of their time arguing, they stayed up all night guarding their fields in harvest time, because otherwise their neighbors would sneak over once it was dark and pick the crop that they had put their labor into producing. And it turned out that it was so much trouble enforcing your silly private property rule, keeping people from stealing, that they went back to the sensible, old-fashioned way that all of us people know you should do it. So we go back, we keep having fields in common, and we spend all our time arguing, and time passes. And finally, there is a technological breakthrough, the domestication of the dog. Think of it as the bionic burglar alarm. Because dogs are territorial animals. And my dog knows the boundaries of my property. He's probably peed along them, actually, just to convince any other dog to stay off. And I can sleep soundly, because I know that if any neighbor crosses that border, I'm going to be woken by a torrent of barks, and he's going to be bit if he's not careful, and now we can finally have private property. So that's, as I said, this is purely conjectural. The only relevant fact is that the rise of agriculture occurs at about the same time as the domestication of the dog. You know, give or take 1,000 years, we don't have very accurate information that far back. But it could be true. And now I claim, once we have private property and land, now agriculture takes off, and from there to where we are now, it's all downhill. So that's why we owe civilization to the dogs. I don't know if it's true, but it could be true. And it does illustrate the point that what the right legal rules are depends in part on the cost of enforcing. Final solution is the one that most people think of when you refer to public goods, and that's have the government produce the public good. And national defense is an obvious example. That if we defend America from the Russians or the Mexicans or whoever, or the Canadians, whoever might want to attack us, we're defending all of us. So therefore, why should I contribute any money if the rest of you people contribute enough money? I'm safe. If not, mine won't make the difference. So we have taxation, we all have to contribute, we provide national defense. The book puts it as there would be no defense without it. And historically that's wrong, because there have been societies that had no government and nonetheless protected themselves. And my favorite example is the Comanche Indians. The Comanche Indians were anarchists. There was nothing we would recognize as a government in that system. A war chief simply meant an entrepreneur people would follow. That you were a war chief if when you said, I'm going to go raid the Cheyenne, some people were willing to follow you. They weren't willing to follow you, you weren't a war chief. So it was a system without a government, but it was also a society where there were very large non-monetary payoffs to being a successful warrior. It was how you got status, and also you could loot the people you warriored against. And the result was that although the Cheyenne were outnumbered and technologically outgunned, for about two decades, they prevented the expansion of Americans across Texas. They were very, very good at fighting. The Comanche. The Comanche were pretty good, but less good.
The Comanches originated across that border?
The Comanches are on the southern part of the Great Plains. I'm not sure if that's where they originated. I think all of the Plains Indians, if you trace it back far enough, migrated to the Plains. Because what we think of as the traditional Indian way of life with riding horses and hunting buffalo only became possible after the Spanish brought in horses. There were all essentially the megafauna of the New World probably was killed off by humans. We don't know for sure, but we know that not long after humans come into North America across the Bering Strait, the big animals start disappearing. And one has a suspicion that you know who's guilty. But in any case, at the point when Europeans arrived in the New World, there were no horses. They had been killed off, but not horses, but what would have become horses, so to speak. And the Spanish brought horses. Some of those horses got out and started breeding in the wild, and the result was that the whole plain... I mean, it's interesting because we think of primitive people as conservative. They do the same thing. This is a whole bunch of primitive people, all of the plains tribes, which, like within one or two generations, invented a whole new style of life for themselves. They had been farmers, sort of scratching, living out of the land with some difficulty, and suddenly here are these horses. They learn to use horses. They start hunting buffalo, and suddenly they're the lords of the plains. Interesting case of innovation by people we would think of mistakenly as stick in the muds. But in any case, so I think most of the Plains tribes, and probably the Comanche too, had migrated there, I don't know, you know, in the 16th century or something, at some point after the Spaniards arrived. Right. But the point I'm describing, they were basically the Southern Plains, the area around Texas, across the Mexican border. They raided into Mexico. They were tough guys. Anyway, so it's not impossible to have defense without a government, but there are clearly very serious problems to doing it, and I'm not sure we want to have the culture the Comanche had, however effective it was in that respect. They fought each other a lot, too. I think mostly not lethally. So we've discussed the problem with private production. What are the problems with public production? And there are the usual two problems that we've discussed with regulation and things. One of them is that even with the best of intentions, it's hard for the public producer to figure out what public goods are worth producing, how much of them you should produce, and so forth. We have all these stories about, you know, $500 toilet seats and such for the military. Probably some of them are exaggerated, but you can see that there are reasons why, if the way you produce a good is to say, all right, you can tax people and produce the good, you might not do as good a job as you would hope. And, of course, even if the people producing the good knew how to do it in the way with the benefit the public interest, they might choose not to because they might have ways of benefiting themselves or their political patrons or whoever it was instead. So government production is a solution, but like all of the solutions, we've got the hard problem. It's an imperfect solution. Let me now turn it around, and instead of discussing why governments do a bad job of producing public goods, discuss why the public good problem is part of the reason that governments do a bad job. Because I want to apply the public good problem now not to the enterprise of defending us, but to the enterprise of controlling government. All right? We would like to have a mechanism whereby it was in the interests of governmental actors to do good things. And the public good problem is one of the reasons we don't, one of the reasons why it's hard to make governments behave, so to speak. And let me start with what I think of as the civic class model of democracy. the sort of simple model, and it's really very plain. It is, why do politicians have to do the right thing? Because if they do the wrong thing, we'll vote them out and replace them with other politicians. And the problem for that model is that it requires that the voters know whether the politicians are doing the right thing. And in order for me to know whether the politician is doing the right thing, I need quite a lot of expensive information. I need to know what bills he supported, how he voted on them, what the content of that 130-page long bill was, what its real effect was instead of the effect of what it said it was doing, which was always good. Why he voted the way he did, because after all, even if he voted against something I'm in favor of, maybe the reason was he wanted to vote it down to get an even better version. I don't know. So doing a good job of figuring out whether politicians are really serving me is not a costless activity. It takes a lot of time and effort. What's the payoff? We're rational individuals. We do things when our benefit is larger than the cost. What do I get if I decide to devote 10 hours a week to monitoring, as it were, my congresswoman or congressman? Is Zoe Lofgren from this district? I'm not sure. Who is the congressperson in this district?
For San Jose.
For San Jose, yeah. Zoe Lofgren, yeah.
How do you spell that last name?
L-O-F-G-R-E-N. Anyway, so if I decide to spend 10 hours a week keeping track of what bills Zoe Lofgren introduces and how she votes on other people's bills and stuff like that, what do I get for it? I get to decide whether to vote for her, and the chances that will decide whether she's reelected is so close to zero that it doesn't matter. All right? If it's a presidential election, that's even more so. All right, we had a presidential election a while ago where if you could have changed 500 votes in Florida, you might have changed the outcome. That's the closest we've ever come, I think. I don't get 500 votes and I'm not in Florida. I get one vote. So that means that there is no incentive for me to be a rational and well-informed voter. And we have just proved the result of this in this room 2 minutes ago. Because when I asked who the congressperson was from this district, I think only one person knew the answer. And it's real hard to know if your congressperson is... Well, I had a guess at the answer, so maybe two. It's real hard to know if your congressperson is doing a good job if you don't know who she is. So my claim is that all of us and essentially all voters are rationally ignorant. It's rational to be ignorant when information costs more than it's worth. And information necessary to monitor the government and know what it's doing almost always costs where it's worth. So that implies that the simple model of democracy isn't going to work, that something is going to determine what happens, but it isn't as simple as the voters will vote you out if you do a bad job, because the voters won't know if you're doing a bad job. Anytime a congressperson introduces, no one has ever introduced a farm bill, for example, which said in the prologue, the purpose of this bill is to make farmers richer and city folk poorer. That is the purpose of all farm bills, in fact, because they're designed basically to push up the price of food. But they always explain that the purpose is to make sure that America has a healthy agricultural industry in order that we won't all starve to death. They don't put it quite that crudely. And it's obviously in the interest of the person writing the bill to only say good things about it. It might be in the interest of opponents to say bad things, but why should you believe them either? You have no way without spending a lot of effort of knowing. So that's first application of public good problem to the political marketplace, is it explains why the political marketplace we have rational ignorance. But it goes further. It explains to some extent what laws get passed. Because consider a law which benefits a small group of beneficiaries, sort of like my two big farmers, at the cost of a very large and dispersed group of victims. So, for instance, suppose the law is an auto tariff, or an auto bailout bill for them. Make it an auto tariff. An auto tariff benefits the auto companies. It benefits the United Auto Workers Union. It benefits the city government of Detroit and probably the state government of Michigan, because they produce a lot of cars. And it isn't very hard for the small number of auto companies to get together with the UAW, who they talk to all the time anyway, and to a few local politicians in Michigan and say, look, we want to get that auto tariff passed. Ford will put in $1 million. GM should put in $2 million. They're bigger than we are. United Auto Workers, can you talk to some congressmen about the fact that they'd like your people to work for them and to vote for them in the next election? Senator from Michigan, do you think you could talk to some other senators about trading votes on other things for their votes on an auto tariff? All right. So it's the auto tariff is a public good for the auto industry, but it's a public good with a real small public. It's a public good because if Ford refused to contribute and they got the tariff anyway, Ford would still benefit. But it's a public good with a small number of players, and therefore it's practical for them to coordinate. Who pays for the auto tariffs? Everybody who buys cars, because they make cars more expensive. And although it's less obvious, all export industries pay, because the auto tariff means that we buy less from foreigners, and the result is they have less of our money to buy stuff from us with. And that's more complicated. But the result, basically, is that the cost of the tariff is dispersed among almost 300 million people, who mostly don't talk to each other. The benefit is divided among maybe a dozen organizations who do talk to each other. So if the suppose the effect of the auto tariff is that the auto industry is $5 billion better off, and the rest of us are $20 billion worse off. So in that case, it's undesirable in terms of the overall effect. If the auto industry is $5 billion better off, I bet they can raise $1 billion to buy the tariff, $1 billion to contribute in one form or another. If the rest of us are $20 billion worse off, we're never going to raise anything close to $20 billion to fight it because we're a dispersed interest group. Each of us has only a tiny amount to stake. So that suggests that one of the patterns you should observe in what law, what bills get passed is a tendency to redistribute income away from dispersed interest groups and towards concentrated interest groups. And there's an economist by called Gary Becker who has a sort of a empirical rule about farm policy. And his rule is that if you look at any country, if it's a country like the US or Europe where the farmers are a very small fraction of the population, the purpose of farm policy is to make food more expensive in order to make farmers better off. If it's a country like many of the third world countries where the bulk of the population are poor peasants, then the purpose of farm policy is to make farm goods less expensive so as to buy the support of the urban mob, which is politically influential, at the cost of the dispersed farmers. And as far as I know, New Zealand is the exception to this rule, because as far as I know, New Zealand is the only country in the known world which neither subsidizes nor specially taxes farmers, agriculture. And why that is, I don't know, except that the NZs are oddballs. I'm good for them. They've also, by the way, got legal prostitution, as I discovered not long ago. I've had it since 2003. Another respect in which I think they're the only country that has it fully legal as opposed to in some limited area the way Amsterdam does. Anyway, so this gives us a prediction and in particular explains tariffs because the economics of tariffs were worked out by David Ricardo about 1815 or so, quite a while back. Most economists since then have realized that tariffs, with rare exceptions, make the country that imposed them poorer, but they make the protected industry richer at the expense of a very dispersed interest group, and therefore they're politically profitable, and therefore you get them. We go on to a final subject, I hope it's final because we're running out of time, which is what we sometimes refer to as welfare economics, which doesn't mean welfare payments, it means how do we decide whether some change is good or not, whether it's an improvement. And I discussed that somewhat casually in the context of consumer surplus and producer surplus. And I now want to go a little more detail into what we're doing. So imagine that an economist is asked by somebody, should we have strict liability or negligence in tort law? Should we have auto tariffs or not? Should we restrict immigration or follow our old policy of letting anybody come who wants to come? And the first response of an economist is, what is this should business? I'm an economist, not a moral philosopher. If you have tariffs, this is what will happen. If you have strict liability, this is what will happen. How can I know whether it's good or bad? But they won't leave us alone. They want answers. And finally, in desperation, this is an imaginary scenario, but I think it's got the guts of what happens. In desperation, the economist says, here's what I'll do. I'll create a definition of good. A definition of what it means to make America or the world a better place. And this definition has two characteristics. It's not exactly what you're asking about, but it's close. All right. On the whole, something that's good in my terms probably is good in your term. Might not be, probably. And second, It's a definition simple enough so we can answer your damn questions. So that I can't tell you if tariffs are good. But I can tell you that tariffs reduce economic efficiency. And economic efficiency is at least first cousin to what you mean by good. I can't, and so forth for these other ones. So what do we mean by economic efficiency? And my description of it, which is not how most current textbooks put it, but it's how most economists really do it, and it's based on what I suppose the greatest economist of the last 120 years, namely Alfred Marshall, did. He's the guy who really put modern economics together. And what he says is, imagine some change like a tariff. Suppose you could ask everybody, how much do you gain or lose measured by what would you pay to get it or to stop it? All right? And assume everybody's fully informed about the effects of the tariff. So our only question is, do they like them or not? So we say, all right, how much would you pay to stop it? How much would you pay to stop it? How much would you pay to get it? All right. Add up all the negatives, the people who want to stop it, and all the positives. If the positives are bigger than the negatives, we say it's an improvement. If the negatives are bigger than the positives, we say it's a worsening. All right? And that's, in effect, what economic efficiency is doing. So take the very, very simple case. I have an apple. Sorry, there's an apple out there. And the question is, do I get it or do you get it? If I'm willing to pay a dollar for it and you're willing to pay 50 cents for it, giving it to me is a gain of a dollar, giving it to you is a gain of 50 cents. A dollar is bigger than 50 cents. You'd vote giving it to me instead of you see as a minus 50, giving it to me instead of you I see as a plus 1.0, net 50 cents. Therefore, it's more efficient to give it to me. And that's what will happen if we auction it off, obviously. But you can generalize that, and you can say, for any choice at all, in principle, if people knew the effects, how much would they offer either way? And that defines what's a gain or a loss. Now, what's the problem with it? Why do I say it's only first cousin, or maybe second cousin to what you want? To begin with, it assumes that we can measure value by what people want, not by what they should want. So we observe that a diabetic is willing to pay money for insulin, and that's a measure of the value of insulin to a diabetic. We observe that a heroin user is willing to pay money for heroin, and that's a measure of the value of heroin to a heroin user. So we're not willing to go behind it and say, well, the diabetic is buying health, which is good, and he's right, but the heroin user is making a mistake. We say, no, we accept people's own values for whatever they value. Second problem is that because we're asking how much you would be willing to pay, we're acting as if a dollar represented the same importance to everybody. So we're summing up Bill Gates' dollar and the homeless person's dollar and saying, well, if Bill Gates gains by $2, homeless person loses by a dollar, net gain of a dollar, it's good. And that doesn't fit people's intuition of good very well. And finally, it's assuming that all that matters to goodness is people. That the only question is, how does it affect people? But suppose that somewhere out in the forest there was the oldest tree in the world. And suppose no human being gave a damn about it. Maybe they didn't even know it was the oldest tree in the world. But cutting it down, we can get some lumber out of it. By the efficiency criterion, cutting it down is a gain. All right? Somebody's get benefits, nobody loses. Some people might say yes, but having that tree exist is an independent value somehow. God wants that tree to exist, so to speak. And if you're willing to say that there are values that aren't human values, that's a third problem with the definition. On the other hand, the arguments for saying it's at least close to what we want is that for many of the issues we're looking at, we are not benefiting Bill Gates and hurting a homeless person. We're benefiting Bill Gates and hurting some other billionaire. We're benefiting one homeless person hurting another. That is, we typically, economic effects affect lots of people in lots of different ways. So probably if when we averaged out the dollars that came out positive, the odds are pretty good that if we averaged out happiness, it would come out positive too, though of course it might not. Furthermore, if you think that taking a dollar from Gates to give it to the homeless person is a good thing because the dollar is worth more to the homeless person, why don't you go have Congress vote a tax and a welfare system and do it directly instead of trying to build it into your definition of efficiency? another reason for using this way of doing it is that we can set up institutions that reflect dollar values, such as a market where you bid. It's much harder to figure out how you would have everything go to the guy who it makes happiest, because anybody can say it makes him happy, but it doesn't prove it. So there are a variety of reasons why economists, many economists, think this is as close to a criterion of what's good or bad as in practice we can get. Final comment is that reading the chapter, you will see that the book's treatment of many of these issues is not the same as mine. This and law and econ are really my field. I agree with some things in the book, disagree with others. I believe mine is right, which is why I put it this way. Their treatment is more nearly conventional. It comes closer to what the average textbook not written by me will say. And therefore, the obvious conclusion is that you should read the book as well as listening to what I say, and thus have two different angles on the same subject. All right?